It was at the time, too, when there were, during the early and mid-60s, jobs were pretty readily available. Now, that was way long before the ADA, so there was a whole just belief in the community that blind folks, particularly, even people with disabilities, that employers didn't have to consider them for employment. And I always thought that was bunk. But so that's how that was. But within the Federal Rehab Services Administration, and it might not have been called that at that time, there was the director of RSA at that time was a very innovative, forceful lady who put a lot of federal money into developing specialized training programs, particularly for blind folks. And there was like the interpreter training program that was started in a couple of different locations in the country to train blind folks as interpreters to maybe work in the foreign services. There was the computer training programs, again, in a couple of different locations. We had one in Los Angeles at a place called Systems Development Corporation, and people, blind folks from throughout the state, would go to that training program for 8 or 9 months, and if they got through that, they went to work, because, you know, programming was hot. It was a hot employment item at that time. This was all because of this lady's, oh, the other one that was near and dear to my heart that I liked a lot was training as a machinist. And there were a number of blind folks who were trained. I think the training site was in South Dakota or someplace. And they were trained as machinists using calipers that were developed so that blind folks could measure down to a thousandth of an inch the diameter of things that they were cutting on lathes. And I know a number of people who were employed as machinists and worked for a number of years. This was kind of before machining became as automated as it is now. But at that time, there was an awful lot of, you know, machine work that was done by individuals running lathes, and so that program. And then there was a piano hospital and training center in Vancouver, Washington. And piano tuning, because of the residential schools for the blind, that was one of the trade programs that almost all schools for the blind offered, schools for the blind across the country. And a gentleman by the name of Emil Fries started the one in Vancouver, Washington, and this was not connected with high school or with, you know, schools for the blind, but for adults who wanted to become a piano tuner, a technician, really, that could rebuild pianos from ground up. And there were a number of blind folks that went through those training programs. So there was a lot of employment opportunities that were available. I always felt that if I could catch a person early enough as a rehab counselor and get them thinking about what they could do, not what they could not do, that this would make a big difference in their working. And I have to say that my record with the Department of Rehab as a rehab counselor was probably one of the best. I placed nearly 20 clients every year in competitive employment, you know, for the years that I was a rehab counselor.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a good time in the economy. That began to taper out in the late 60s as the economy, inflation started going up and the economy started changing and the auto industry started losing jobs and not selling as many cars because better cars were coming in from Japan. That had a real impact on what opportunities blind folks had. Mm-hmm. At that time, probably one of the things that changed my life the most was going to a 6-week training program in Carbondale, Illinois, at the Southern Illinois University. And it was a federally funded training program. And California sent, the year I went, I think there were 4 or 5 counselors for the blind who were sent back there for the 6-week training program. It made all the difference in the world to me about how I viewed employment and how I approached helping people get jobs. It was a major turning point in my life professionally.
Was this sponsored by the then predecessor to the RSA?
Yes.
And these activities were, I think the rehab director, RSA director you're talking about is Mary Switzer?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's absolutely right. Yes. I never met her in person. I always wished that I had. But I saw the programs that she advocated for and got funding for. And I saw the impact that it had, and what a thinker! But it was also at the right time in the economy, so it was a number of things that came together. What was working against that, I guess, and kind of back to your original question, we began to see more and more blind folks coming into the rehab system who were blinded because of what was then called retrohepatic fibroplasia, now called ROP, retinopathy of prematurity. And that was a result of too much oxygen for preemies, babies 2 pounds and of weight and in that area. And they didn't know that giving 100% oxygen often led to retinal detachments and other other side effects that were harder to quantify. But a number of people that came to rehab, not only were they blind, but they had very, very poor spatial orientation, and maybe as a result of that or whatever, their parents coddled them. I had one parent proudly say to me that her son didn't have to climb a flight of stairs until he was 10 years old.
Wow.
And what that means in terms of experience and falling out of trees and all the things that kids do, and the kind of the normalization of kids. That young man, the last I knew, still is not working, and he never will. And we had a number of people. There was the epidemic in the early, so-called epidemic, in the early 50s, until they figured out that oxygen, 100% oxygen, was too much oxygen, and they began to figure out how to taper that back so that it kept the child alive, but didn't always cause some of the blindness, or some of the other deficiencies that I'd mentioned. It was hard to talk about all this because most of the, as I believe it to be true, most of the people that had the challenges of poor spatial orientation and poor self-concept and dependency. You couldn't measure that. You couldn't diagnose it. The doctor didn't get it. There were no ways to quantify that, not with the medical technology that was available at those times. But those of us who worked with those folks, we knew them. The standing story was, well, there's an RLF. Do you think they'll go to work? And many did. Many did. So it wasn't just an all or nothing kind of thing.
And just to put a finer point on it, the deficiencies of RLF are not retina deficiencies. The deficiencies were a generation of babies that were kept immobile and prevented from exploring and developing like sighted kids. And that produced a generation with very poor spatial discrimination and other skills. Do you think that's what really went on?
I think that's a factor in it. And although it, you know, I've never seen any studies that verify that, but when a child is born at 7 months and 2 pounds of weight or less, and you know, given oxygen, the brain has not had time to develop inner uterus the way that a full-term baby's brain will develop. And so I'm in addition to what you said about the social impact, the social and experiential impact of blindness, I think there were some minimal brain issues, brain development issues that were so subtle that, you know, they could not determine them, but you could sure see them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not an all or nothing kind of thing, but I think it's a combination of those two. And again, not everybody that came through that had that. You know, we both know blind folks that were born in that era who were preemies, who were doing just fine. Thank you very much.
Right. So going back to your early marriage and your confidence, your self-confidence that you could support a family and have a decent life and all that, you once came to one of the Lighthouse's employment immersion classes, and somebody asked you about how many gaps you had in your employment and how long you were unemployed. And you had a kind of interesting answer. You want to remember that that question?
Kind of, I do. What I think you're getting to is that I never had to go looking for a job. Jobs came looking for me. And, I mean, that's a wonderful position to be in. But in my case, it has always been true. I mean, I had to be in the right place at the right time and say the right things and all that, of course. But except for my first job, which I got by passing a test with the state, and then, you know, going through an oral interview, and then I was asked to, you know, come to work. Of course, that was after having sent out 180 resumes after I got my master's degree and getting 2 interviews. So it wasn't all, you know, brightness and sunshine by any means. But once I got a full-time job and became known, jobs came looking for me. Kay Wood came looking for me when I went to work in Illinois. They came looking for me, and when I came to work for AFB, I was approached. And that's, you know, that's a really nice position to be able to be in.
And I think you totaled up the years, and from the time you were successful for that first job, it was 44 years, if I remember correctly.
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah.
44 years. And it could have gone longer, but with the family situation I had at that time, raising three grandkids, being guardians for three grandchildren, my wife kind of said, you know, you need to be around here more. I need your help.
That's right. So it's a good time to return to the lighthouse. And in the mid-1980s, we're approaching the bad old days. And it's sometimes very instructive to understand how organizations sometimes lose their way and why they do, and then what happens when they eventually find their way again. So with kindness to the past, but also with determination to say things the way they were, you want to tell us what happened in the mid-1980s at the Lighthouse?
Well, I don't... the one thing I wanted to share is to talk a little bit about when we just made the decision to close the Lighthouse Workshop. And that preceded the kind of decline that you're asking about, but I think it's an important it was an important milestone in the Lighthouse Blind Craft that had been established in 1914 had for years and years and years employed many people, and this was at the time clearly when blind folks were not working in other industries, and sheltered employment was the only thing for many of them that was available. And I'm told that during World War II, at times they were running double shifts because Lighthouse Workshop was producing goods for the service, you know, for men in service. Through the Wagner-O'Day Act, and were running double shifts. I wasn't involved with the Lighthouse at that time. As I don't know how it kind of deteriorated, but when I came to work at the Lighthouse, there were a number of really bad practices that were in place, particularly in the workshop. People could come to work, and if there was no work, they just sat around and they got paid anyway. They could, and they figured out, as anybody might, how much they could work and earn and still keep their Social Security, disability, or SSI. So they kind of had the best of both worlds. They were, I think it kind of symbolized by the fact that what they were called was employed clients.
Wow.
And I always bristled at that word. And then the equipment that we had was so outdated. Making brooms, which was one of the things that kept the workshop going, making brooms and then making planters out of redwood were the two major works products from the workshop. Making brooms was out of broom corn is an incredibly takes a lot of skill. To do it right and to, you know, get the brooms and with the equipment we had to do it safely. I don't know if OSHA ever came in, but if they had, I believe they would have shut us down.
Wow.
You know, there'd be, you'd have a broom that you were putting together and you'd stick it into this whirling series of pegs that would comb the broom corn out, and you know, so you'd have a nice straight broom, and so you just lay the broom up against this whirling series of pegs, and it would do that. You better not get your hand in there, though. It would comb your hand, too. Anyway, so with those two things, that the personnel practices that were very patronizing and the equipment issue, the decision was made to close the workshop. And we gave it a year, and we hired a placement person to come and provide placement assistance to anybody in the workshop that wanted to get a job outside. And we actually placed two or three people, but most people, they would have none of it. They knew the workshop was going to close, and they just ran it out to the end. And we closed it, I think it was 1981, it was the final year of the workshop. That was not part of the decline that began to occur a couple of years later, but it definitely changed what the Lighthouse was known for in the community, in the blind community, and in the rehab community. What began to happen, though, of course, a lot of it was money, and some of it was leadership of the agency. Jim Kaywood, who I still have much regard for, developed some health issues and was eventually asked to retire by the board, and they phased him out over, they were nice to him, phased him out over 9 months. I was acting exec during the time that he was not here, when they were recruiting another director. A gentleman was hired, and those were bad times. I would just say it that way.
Just a few more details. The hiring body was the board of directors?
Yes.
And what was the composition of the board then?
To my knowledge, there were no blind people on the board at that point. They were business people. They did not do a background check on this person, Gil Orlick, and he lasted about 10 months.
What did he do?
He was a very knowledgeable guy. I think he had his master's in social work. He had run other agencies, so he had management experience. He knew how to get a hold of the PowerPoints within an organization, and within a week, he had all the check signing privileges on his desk for the whole agency. Any check that went out had to have his signature on it. And the control that gave him began to undermine what many of us, the confidence that we had in our own judgments. And it just began. And then he fired a long time fundraiser, well, Jack Sorries, who was a fundraiser and development person. And that probably had more of an impact on people, on the staff's morale, than anything. And it just continued to go downhill from there. Over the objection of many, he brought in a mini computer into the agency. When computers were not being used much in agencies like the Lighthouse, and yet he brought in a mini computer.
This would be what, 83, 84?
83.
Okay.
I don't know if this is true, but I'd heard that there was some kickback that he got from having purchased the mini computer for the lighthouse. Anyway, when he left, the mini computer went away too. And in the midst of all that, you know, fundraising, of course, suffered, as did community relations, because, you know, people knew. And morale around here was really terrible. It's the only time I've ever quit a job, and I was asked by the board and by staff to not quit. And I decided to stay, feeling fairly certain that his days were numbered, because there was no way I could have continued working with him. I mean, he was never mean or abusive to me, but his management was just, it was so different than Kay Wood's and what I'd gotten used to.
When Kay Wood left, did you consider applying for the position?
I did. And I was not selected. Actually, I applied when after he left and they recruited another person. I applied again and was not selected. I was acting exec, during that interim, but I was not chosen. And I'm sure blindness had something to do with that, because the board really did not have that much of an understanding of blindness. I mean, they knew they ran an agency for the blind, but with the exception of myself and three or four other staff, those were the only blind folks that the board ever knew about.
Mm-hmm.
So then the next director was hired, and he was my committee.
How do you spell that last name?
C-O-M-I-N-I. It looks funny in Braille. C-O-M-I-N-I.
Got it.
It looks very funny in Braille. Anyway, Mike and I got along quite well. He too was a MSW person. I think he'd been working in Buffalo, New York, or somewhere, and was hired and brought in. But again, the fundraising and the results of inflation from the late 70s and mid 80s was having a tremendous impact. And we really did not have a very focused fundraising program. You know, we had some good people trying to do it, but it was hard to tell our story because there were so many things that we had started to do that we were pulling back from doing. As money began to shrink, we began to cut back on the clinical services. The children's services program closed, the deafblind grant went away. So we began to lose things. And then we never did have much of a particularly good reputation with the Department of Rehab. Some clients would get referred. We never could really get our finger on exactly why that was. Oh, hang on.
4, 1, 5, 6, 9, 4, 7, 3, 4, 3.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I lost my thought.
poor connection with Department of Rehab.
Oh, yeah, and some of us thought that it was, oh, go away.
4, 1, 5, 6, 9, 4, 7, 3, 4, 3.
See what that does.
This is a good demonstration of accessible technology that you're using.
Now, if I had my iPhone, I'd just punch it twice and it would send it to voicemail. But some of us thought that it was the leadership in Sacramento that didn't think what the Lighthouse was doing would be helpful to their clients. Whether that was the case or not, I don't know. But we didn't get a lot of referrals, and so the some for mobility, but that was about it.
The leadership in Sacramento, then, would that be Manuel Urena?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And again, he was always cordial to me and all that, but we think the word came down of, don't go there. Anyway, so things began to unravel. My committee did, everything that he could. The auxiliaries, the Lighthouse had 3 auxiliaries, mostly of women. The Peninsula Auxiliary, which actually raised a good bit of money for camp, and for other things too, but mostly for camp. The San Francisco Auxiliary, when I came on board, it was trying hard, but it was struggling to raise the money that they wanted to raise. And then the Davis-Dixon Auxiliary. And I had a really good relationship. Well, the Lighthouse had a good relationship with the Davis-Dixon Auxiliary. And they raised as much money as they could. But those began to phase out. The leadership of the auxiliaries, the women began to age out. And I think auxiliaries' time was past. We never could get an auxiliary established in Napa. We tried, but we couldn't get a toehold there. And so that source of funding went away. And I began to get restless because some of the things that I was trying to build and to maintain were not getting the funding that was needed. And my role was changing. I mean, committee was always, very, very nice to me and all that. But he, at one point, thought that what I should do would be to spend more of my time working on legislation issues in Sacramento. And I knew that wasn't for me. And that's so then in 87, a job opportunity came along to direct the rehab program in Illinois, and I decided to take that.
And we'll go into that in a future chapter, but a few other things happened right in those years, 85, 86, 87. One of them was O.J. May and her tenure at camp. She had been director at Enchanted Hills for 10 years. What happened?